we are in the chapter The Eternal and the Individual. And can you give me the page number?
On the PDF, it's page 393. Our
393, okay, 393. And so what we've covered so far in the earlier, last time, Sri Aurobindo is pointing out that there seems to be a number of contradictions in assuming that there is some kind of infinite, eternal, or absolute, and that our existence cannot fully comprehend that, or if it does comprehend it, it's in another dimension of experience. And so we have to bring our minds to some kind of a reconciliation of these two dimensions, or these two possibilities of reality. And so he's saying that if such the mind, by its rational logic, deals in the law of non-contradiction, so it takes it that either this is true, our phenomenal experience is true, and there is no infinite existence outside of this, no eternal, no absolute, or that the absolute is true, and what we experience as phenomenal existence is some kind of a illusion, a phenomenal illusion of phenomena, and or what it is that there seems to have appeared out of some absolute origin a temporary condition of phenomenal existence, and it will return. So it is an appearance in time, and it will return to its origin, which is that of an absolute existence. So Sri Aurobindo takes these various positions, and he, in the last paragraph that we dealt with, he has a long persona, quotation from a persona that he assumes, that one might call this rational persona. And he ends by saying that they are spurious arguments made by the mind, which is taking its own vantage as the arbiter of truth. So that's why he says the last line in what we studied is, or the last few lines, after putting forth this argument, Sri Aurobindo says, yet is there here a triple error, the error of making an unbridgeable gulf between the absolute and the relative, the error of making too simple and rigid and extending too far the law of contradictions, and the error of conceiving in terms of time the genesis of things which have their origin and first habitat in the eternal. So these are the problems of the rational mind. Firstly, it assumes that if we have an experience of relative realities, there can be no absolute. Or if there is to be an absolute, it cannot have any relationship with the world of relative realities. The second one is the error of making too simple and rigid and extending too far the law of contradictions. Again, this is a truth which belongs to the finite. It belongs to a reality in which something can be asserted and the same thing cannot be negated. See, so that kind of a kind of a law or logic applies to certainly it applies to mental reasoning, but it doesn't apply to the infinite faced by the finite, because the finite in its relationship to the infinite is bound to approach it through the law of contradictions. Whatever is asserted is overpassed by the infinite, and hence it can be negated by the infinite. And so that negation becomes the basis of a new assertion, and that assertion again, as soon as it is made, is bound by its own finitude and hence can be negated. So we arrive at a succession of continuous progression in asserting and negating realities, because we are faced with an infinite. Hence, to the mind, what is impossible is almost the natural reality of its relationship with the infinite. And the third one is the genesis of the error of conceiving in terms of time the genesis of things which have their origin and first habitat in the eternal, which means that from a certain point of view, nothing is ever happening, that everything from a certain point of view is always there. And yet, from another point of view, which is the point of view of the dimension of time, it is the experience of that radical infinity that is mapped out in a kind of a progressive or a temporal phenomenology without end, without beginning and without end. So these are the problems, these are the triple errors which are natural to the rational mind trying to pass judgment on the infinite. And so with that, Sri Aurobindo launches into what we are going to study today, which is what is the reality of the relationship between the absolute and the relative. So unless there are any questions, comments, we can proceed from here.
So are we going to start with the paragraph starting by "we mean by the absolute"?
Yes, yes, that's what we'll start with.
I can go first. We mean by the absolute something greater than ourselves, greater than the cosmos which we live in, the supreme reality of that transcendent being which we call God, something without which all that we see or are conscious of as existing could not have been, could not for a moment remain in existence. Indian thought calls it Brahman, European thought the absolute, because it is self-existent, which is absolved of all bondage to relativities. For all relatives can only exist by something which is the truth of them all and the source and continent of their powers and properties, and yet exceeds them all. It is something of which not only each relativity itself, but also any sum we can make of all relatives that we know, can only be, in all that we know of them, a partial, inferior, or practical expression. We see by reason that such an absolute must exist. We become by spiritual experience aware of its existence. But even when we are most aware of it, we cannot describe it, because our language and thought can deal only with the relative. The absolute is for us the ineffable.
So here Sri Aurobindo is pointing to the nature of the absolute and to the problem which the mind encounters in approaching the absolute. And as he says over here, if we live in a world of relations or of relatives where everything is relative to something else, frames of reference that are relative to one another, and yet we have commonalities in which we live. We have a universe which is, you know, sort of experienced by everybody as having a certain kind of common basis for our experience. We have to realize our relativities in relation to something which is outside of those relativities. This is what is called the absolute. The absolute cannot be a part of the relative world. So the absolute, there is a gulf between the absolute and the world of relatives. Yet the world of relatives is upheld by the absolute. The absolute is the basis of foundation against which the backdrop, against which the dimension of relativity exists. So he points out that such a conception exists in Western philosophy. That's why we use the term the absolute. But such a conception exists in Indian philosophy too, and we know it as Brahman. He points out that as the philosophical approach which proceeds through the reason, and as I said, through the reason, if we talk about the entire metaphysical tradition of Western philosophy, that we assume the existence of such an absolute to become the background against which relativities can be defined as relative. They are relative to what? They are relative to each other, and they are relative to an absolute. So that is why he says we see by reason that such an absolute must exist. But then he moves to the Indian side of things, which he has called the Brahman, and he says there is another tradition by which we can approach it, and that is the tradition of spiritual experience. And by spiritual experience, we can become aware of its existence. So we can become aware of this so-called logical possibility as a dimension of experience that in some way we can experience, but at the same time which from which all relativities drop off. It is the Brahman, it is the Satchidananda, it is the unthinkable, it is the unknowable. We can experience it, but in experiencing it, we have, as it were, crossed the gulf between the world of relatives and that which is seamless, without any relatives, without any definition, indescribable and illimitable. So that absolute, that radical infinity of the absolute, cannot be described. Because as he says, our language and thought can only deal with the relative. So we use a term for it, which is the ineffable. The ineffable in the sense that, or we could use the term indescribable. It escapes from all our attempts in the world of relatives to describe it, grasp it, etc. This is partly why all mystical traditions, and in the Eastern sense, the traditions that Sri Aurobindo is drawing from, we can think about the Upanishads, speak about the world of language as, at its highest possibility, a finger pointing and indicating. So that which is indicated always is at a gulf from the world of indicators. Or we can use symbols, which is what the Veda does. Or we can use paradox, which is what the Upanishad does. We are using language to assert something about something which cannot be sort of talked or described in any way. We can describe aspects of it. We can describe parts and portions of it. But we cannot describe it as it truly is, because it escapes all the possibilities of description, since all description is objective. We cannot objectify it because that has subtended all objects and all relatives, all relations. Objects and relations have been subtended by that. So this is where he's staging the fact that when the mind makes its approach at judging the absolute, saying that the absolute can have nothing to do with relatives because it escapes the relatives, it is making a grave error because it doesn't have any ability to judge what the absolute can do in its relation with the world of relatives.
Hey. Devashish, I have a question regarding the philosophical thought in the middle of the paragraph there about how all relatives can only exist by something that exceeds them.
Yes.
Is just in the philosophical sense, is that because relativity implies dependence? And if you say, well, all relatives are dependent on each other, you're just going around in a circle, but you never really establish the dependence. Or is it some other,
Yeah, exactly. That relativities, you can't find any particular datum on which they stand. If everything is relative to, you can take any particular standpoint and the ground shifts immediately. So there is an assumption or that there has to be something absolute against which we can define relatives. So that is the philosophical, assumption that he's talking about. That rationally you can only define a world of relativity against something which can be called an absolute.
Thank you.
Now, can it exist or does it exist? That becomes another matter altogether. And then that's why he chooses to describe this in terms of those two traditions, the philosophical tradition and the spiritual tradition. So there is a tradition of experience where we can say we can go in search of this possible absolute against which we can only against which we can describe the world of relations. And when we go in search of that, we can be absorbed into that. And then we find that there is a reduction of the dimension of relativities, and we find only the absolute remains. That's what we are absorbed into. We have moksha, or we have samadhi, which is an absorption. And so that's what he's saying, that it is possible to experience that, both in terms of philosophy and experience. We can assert the reality of the absolute. But we can see that there is a gulf between that and the world of relations or relativities. That gulf is unbridgeable by mind. And that's the reason why mind, when it presumes to pass judgment on the absolute, says that either that does not really exist, or it's, in other words, it's a philosophical convenience to describe things by a certain absolute frame of reference. Or if it does exist, then we do not, the world of phenomena, the relativities do not actually exist. Or the relativities have a temporal existence. They seem to exist in the experience of some experiencers who have arisen out of that and will disappear back into that.
Thank you.
Joanna, would you like to read next?
Oops, sorry, I was on mute. Yes, sure. So far, there need be no real difficulty nor confusion, but we readily go on, led by the mind's habit of oppositions, of thinking by distinctions and pairs of contraries, to speak of it as not only not bound by the limitations of the relative, but as if it were bound by its freedom from limitations, inexorably empty of all power for relations, and in its nature incapable of them, something hostile in its whole being to relativity and its eternal contrary. By this false step of our logic, we get into an impasse. Our own existence and the existence of the universe become not only a mystery, but logically inconceivable. For we get by that to an absolute which is incapable of relativity and exclusive of all relatives, and yet the cause, or at least the support of relativity, and the container, truth, and substance of all relatives. We have then only one logical, illogical way of escape out of the impasse. We have to suppose the imposition of the world as a self-effective illusion or an unreal temporal reality on the eternity of the formless, relationless absolute. This imposition is made by our misleading individual consciousness, which falsely sees Brahman in the figure of the cosmos, as a man mistakes a rope for a serpent. But since either our individual consciousness is itself a relative supported by the Brahman, and only existent by it, not a real reality, or since in its reality it is itself the Brahman, it is the Brahman, after all, which imposes on itself in us this delusion, and mistakes in some figure of its own consciousness an existent rope for a non-existent snake, imposes on its own interminable pure reality the semblance of the universe, or if it does not impose it on its own consciousness, it is not a consciousness derived from it and dependent on it, a projection of itself into Maya. By this explanation, nothing is explained. The original contradiction stands where it was, unreconciled, and we have only stated it over again in other terms. It looks as if, by attempting to arrive at an explanation by means of intellectual reasoning, we have only befogged ourselves by the delusion of our own uncompromising logic. We have imposed on the absolute the imposition which our too presumptuous reasoning has practiced on our own intelligence. We have transformed our mental difficulty in understanding the world manifestation into an original impossibility for the absolute to manifest itself in world at all. But the absolute obviously finds no difficulty in world manifestation, and no difficulty either in a simultaneous transcendence of world manifestation. The difficulty exists only for our mental limitations, which prevent us from grasping the supramental rationality of the coexistence of the infinite and the finite, or seizing the notice of the unconditioned with the conditioned. For our intellectual rationality, these are opposites. For the absolute reason, they are interrelated and not essentially conflicting expressions of one and the same reality. The consciousness of infinite existence is other than our mind consciousness and sense consciousness, greater and more capacious, for it includes them as minor terms of its workings, and the logic of the infinite existence is other than our intellectual logic. It reconciles in its great primal facts of being what to our mental view, concerned as it is with words and ideas derived from secondary facts, are irreconcilable contraries.
So as we saw what he's leading up to in the previous paragraph, he's pointing to the fact that there is the logic of the finite and there is the logic of the infinite. And logic of the finite is really the logic of the object judging the subject, while the logic of the infinite is the logic of the subject to which the object is in relation to itself. It contains and includes it. So here we find towards the very beginning, Sri Aurobindo giving us a sentence that he repeats elsewhere. He repeats in his Thoughts and Aphorisms, one of his really famous aphorisms, as he says there, we readily go on led by the mind's habit of oppositions, of thinking by distinctions and pairs of contraries, to speak of it not only not bound by the limitations of the relative, but as it were bound by its freedom from limitations, inexorably empty of all power for relations, etc. So this is the kind of, you know, echo of what he says in Thoughts and Aphorisms, where he says, God is not bound by his freedom. This great aphorism, God is not bound by his freedom. In other words, if he's free, he can bind himself and still be free. This is the paradox that the rational cannot understand, that which is radically free is free even when it appears to be bound. See, so that is the what he's pointing out here. And then he goes on to talk about the two major arguments in the Indian tradition, the argument of Buddhism and of Advaita Vedanta, where they actually use that metaphor of the rope and the snake. This snake and rope metaphor is used by Shankara, and it has other echoes in other texts throughout the Advaitic as well as the Buddhist corpus. It may actually come from even earlier traditions of popular traditions of magic, for example. You may have heard of the very famous Indian rope trick, where the idea is that a rope sort of extends itself and goes up somebody. It goes up like a snake and goes right up to the kind of an indeterminable height, and someone climbs up and disappears, and then falls down from it in parts. You know, sort of as if the body parts fall down from above. So this kind, and then gets reconstituted, get covered by a piece of cloth and gets reconstituted. So this interesting trick, which starts with this notion of the confusion between a rope and a snake, also relates, of course, to a practical problem. That is, if one looks, goes on a walk or something and sees a rope and mistakes it to be a snake, then one tries to attack it, or one tries to run away from it, when actually it is not a snake at all. So this is the notion of a delusion, the idea of taking something which is something else to be what it isn't. And so we do that because our faculties give us the wrong evidence. And so these traditions are essentially saying that it is only because whatever consciousness is manifesting through our faculties is giving us erroneous evidence that we believe that whatever we experience in the world is true, when actually it is not true. So we have to go back to that to erase that wrong perception. And when we do that, we find that we get out of the realm of relatives and enter back into the absolute. Collapse. There is a collapse of consciousness back into the absolute. So here Sri Aurobindo counters that logic. In other words, he uses logic to counter that logic. And he's pointing to the fact that evidently if an absolute, if a Brahman is holding up these experiences, it is by the power of Brahman that this experience is being had. So it is Brahman that is imposing this illusion on Brahman's own experience. And why should it do that? This raises a very big question, the big why question, which neither Advaita Vedanta nor Buddhism answer, and they don't even address, they don't bring it up. And if it is brought up, then the answer that the texts give is that all questions are not legitimate questions. In other words, this why question is also a error of kind of human consciousness. Human beings, because they experience things in a certain kind of false consciousness, are forced to ask questions like, why does it do it? And the other answer given by Shankara is that Maya is a kind of a magician, and for the delight of its own magic, it does this. It creates these forms of consciousness which experience unrealities, just like the magic trick I was talking about, and believes it to be real. Why would Maya do that? That's also the question. That's why he's raising that question. Even if Brahman has some power of creation, and we call it Maya, we say it's a magician, and it does this for its own delight, why would it do it? Would it do it in that case? I mean, he says it ends up with two particular standpoints on Brahman and Maya. One, that Brahman or Maya is cruel, or are cruel. And the other is that Brahman or Maya or Brahman is impotent. In other words, he has no power to stop this kind of self-illusion, which is a cruel experience for those who experience it. After all, that is the beginning of the Buddha's search, the experience of suffering. Why is it that this experience of suffering is being given out if it is a delight of Maya? Why do we have the experience of suffering? So these become questions that these traditions do not answer and don't believe that they should be answered. Shankara's other answer to this is that Maya is ultimately completely inscrutable. We cannot ask questions beyond a certain point. It is mysterious even to Brahman. It is the very radical mystery of Brahman that makes it do these things. So, or the radical mystery of Maya as an aspect or as the power of Brahman that makes it do these things. So, at a certain point, logic fails even in answering its own stream of thought. And that's what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out over here. But on the other hand, if we go to look from the viewpoint of the Absolute, we see that it is not impossible, and in fact it is very much another order of logic through which we can posit the fact that the Absolute has presented itself in the world of relations as the world of relations, which is the cosmos, and as every relative within the world of relations, which are the individuals. In other words, cosmos and individual, which are the two dimensions that he's talking about in relation to God. So remember, God, cosmos, and the individual are the three dimensions that he's talking about of experience. These three are related and rest on God or the Absolute. These are all aspects. These are nothing other than. Cosmos is a self-presentation of just that same thing that we call Brahman. And individual is another self-presentation of the same thing that we call Brahman. It is all Brahman. Brahman's self-presentations in these three forms. It's also interesting to note that he is countering the reason of the mind approaching reality as the absolute through a certain kind of reason, and he's therefore contesting the primacy of mental reason and pointing to the fact that reason persists beyond mental reason. And so this is why he says the difficulty exists only for our mental limitations, which prevent us from grasping the supramental rationality of the coexisting existence of the infinite and the finite, or seizing the nodus of the unconditioned with the conditioned. In other words, it isn't that reason is limited to its operations in the mind. Reason in the mind is a certain operation of a higher reason, which is what he's calling the supramental reason, the supramental rationality. So what we experience as reason has a higher level of operation through which this relationship between the absolute and the relative is resolved, as it were.
Just a quick comment.
Sure.
I love the challenge that the Kena Upanishads puts to this when it says, I think a few times, this thou hast to think out, I think it known.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful, absolutely. Very, very true.
Kiru, please elaborate a little bit.
Yeah, I think Matteo is pointing to a part in the Kena Upanishad where, who is the persona who is saying that, Matteo? It is Brahman that's saying this, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it is Brahman that's saying it. So it's looking at it, it's as if there is the realm of the known. In other words, that which is known by the divine, that which is known by us when we experience our identity with the divine, or when we experience our reality as the divine, it is known. But this knowledge has to be thought out. In other words, what is the relationship between the finite and the infinite, the relative and the absolute, is not something that can be understood using the rationality of the relative, but yet there is a rationality that has subtended the relative. And so this has to be thought out from the reason of the supermind, of the Brahman himself. So that is the invitation. That which can be known can also be thought out. And this thinking out has to occur from the other side of the gulf, not from the rational mind, but from the supramental rationality.
Another comment. I think it's interesting that he's Earlier on, he was talking about how philosophical logic does posit an absolute, And but it, so just as here, he's saying yes, there is a broader reason, that a different kind of reason or a broader reason that can reconcile these apparent opposites. But even the philosophical reason was pointing out not just the relativities that the senses are aware of, but also that there has to be an absolute in order for this whole situation to be logical. It just doesn't know how to get there on its own.
Correct. Because to it, there's this gulf, and what is the link? That's the point. And that's why he says the nodas prevent us from grasping the supramental rationality of the coexistence of the infinite and the finite, or seizing the nodas of the unconditioned with the conditioned. The nodas, the kind of point of, sort of the point where the two meet, the node, where the unconditioned meets the conditioned, or rather where the unconditioned conditions itself. This is what he's pointing out. Unless you look at it from the viewpoint of the unconditioned, you cannot understand how and where the unconditioned conditions itself. Part of the problem of the philosophical tradition and why they can't grasp this is that they posit reason to the human mind, but they cannot see or cannot posit reason to this absolute. It is as if this absolute cannot have a reason. It cannot become the world of relatives. And yet, so when we say that the rationality of the absolute can reconcile the relativities, it's more than just reconciling. It is actually becoming through its own rationality. This is the reason why that kind of rationality is what Sri Aurobindo calls real idea. Real idea is not just a thinking, but real idea is a becoming through the power of idea. So whatever it thinks, it becomes. Whatever its structure of thought is, are the phenomena that we experience. This is the real idea. This is the rationality of the absolute, of the supermind.
Devashish?
Yes.
What levels of intuition form the notice? Because it seems to me that intuition being the quality that can incorporate all of the different non-logical, non-verbal, as well as verbal and conceptual aspects of consciousness, that the intuition incorporates them all. And it seems as if that would all be needed in order to grasp something in the intellectual rationality of the absolute. So can you just say some more about that?
Yeah. So actually, when you speak about what is the intuition by which we can arrive at that rationality, we say that what is the nodus first and foremost? The nodus is supermind. Supermind is more than intellectual understanding. Supermind is real idea. A supermind is that which has become this cosmos by the power of its own supramental rationality, which is its real idea. So when we talk about this entire cosmos, or we talk about the individual in the cosmos, and remember we started this entire study of this part of the life divine by talking about the determinates and the indeterminates, the determinables and the indeterminates and the indeterminables. We're talking really about this supramental reason that has become all things here. So when we are going the other way around and arriving at this intuition, even when we reason out, there is an intuition behind it. When we are reasoning that there is some kind of order to the cosmos, that there are some laws to the cosmos, and that we can arrive at those laws, even to believe that there is an intuition at work. There is the intuition of the real idea at work in the mind. Now, that same intuition is also at work at lower levels. It is at work in the vital, in a kind of sympathy, in a kind of empathy, in the way in which we feel oneness with other things. It is at work. That's why he says over there, the consciousness of infinite existence is other than our mind consciousness and sense consciousness, greater and more capacious. Because this reason is also acting through our sense consciousness. We somehow intuit through our sense that things are related, that things are ultimately identical, and that both the cosmos and every individual is a self-presentation of the One. So this kind of intuition in sense, in sympathy, in empathy, in instinct, is also an action of the same rationality, which we may call the supramental reason. In the mind, we start becoming aware of the idea power of that particular real idea. So we seek for the laws that allow us to understand everything all at once, to reconcile these differences, these relativities. The intuition of that first takes us beyond our level of mind to what one might call the higher mind. The higher mind is the beginning of the cosmic mind. From that mind, we start perceiving that all these relativities are different ways of speaking of the same, that there are different models of reality that ultimately are you know, ways of describing that same indescribable reality. Further or higher than that, we arrive at what Sri Aurobindo calls the intuition, but he goes through what he calls the illumined mind, which is the world of symbols. And so these archetypes and symbols and intuition for archetypes and symbols and their correlations takes us or comes to us from an even higher plane. And finally, there is the intuition plane itself, where a wordless sense in mind as well as in emotion gives us this knowledge that the One has become everything. Even before we can fully experience it, we live in the sense of that. That living in the sense is what gives its name to the body of text that's called the Upanishad. The Upanishad literally means to sit near. And the sitting near is to live in the sense of the One that has become the cosmos and every individual in it. So that development of that sense is in mind as well as in the level of the senses, the sensations, as well as in the level at the level of the emotions, to bring that particular experience close to us, we are actually drawing from that plane called intuition that Sri Aurobindo talks about. So this is why in the chapter called The Intuitive Mind, in the synthesis of yoga, Sri Aurobindo is calling on us to build a kind of a link between this plane of intuition and our mind and life and body planes, so that the intuitive mind is really a kind of a bridge that connects that and brings the sense of that into our existence.
So it occurs to me that there are two terms here that are not really necessarily the same. Because we're talking a lot about relativity, about relative perspectives and relative ideas. But there's also the concept of relation. And I think there is really a big difference between those. It seems like relative is usually pairs of perspectives that can be seen as contradiction or can be seen as reconciled from another point of view. But relation is in the soup, you know what I mean? But not necessarily of the soup, if that makes sense. I don't know if that makes sense, but you know, what does that make any...
Yeah, Joanne. I think if I were to put it slightly differently, I would say that what you're calling relativities, it not only implies a world of pairs that are in contradictory and need to be reconciled, but they refer to a radical plurality. Relativities means a world of radical plurality. In other words, if we are to say that we are faced with a world in which we don't know anybody or anything at all, because ultimately everything has a radical difference from whatever we take ourselves to be. So this puts us into a world which is a world of relativities. Each one is relative to others, and these others cannot be known. We can talk about, say, commonalities, our material commonalities. We look in a certain way. We dress in our cultural commonalities. We can talk about our historical commonalities, our ideological commonalities. We believe in a certain religion, for example. But these commonalities don't exhaust the infinite difference between each entity and other entities. At some level, everybody escapes our knowledge. And so this is the world of relativities. Now, the world of relations, as you're saying, is how we bridge these worlds of relativities. And in a way, you're right, that there is already in a world of relations an intuition of something that links us. That is how we have developed over time, expanding that intuition towards what we experience as an age of world union. The fact that human unity can be achieved. We are somewhere at some level, even that is anthropocentric. Maybe we can go beyond and say that global unity is, planetary unity is possible, or a certain kind of unity of all things is possible. Now, even that would be to be in relation with other things. That intuition would drive our relations, which would expand towards greater and greater closeness. We would create the instruments of relations by which relationalities would bridge the relativities. So this is how it is proceeding. There is already an intuition in the development of our own expansion towards human unity, one may say.
Thank you, Devashish.
So this intuition that you're speaking about, of course, so this intuition comes to us from different sources. At the human level, there is another very big source. What is bringing us, what Sri Aurobindo calls the ideal of human unity and the relations that we have between human beings. That is also coming from that intuition of oneness. But that intuition of oneness is operating from what we call the psychic being. There again, there is the same knowledge of the one that has become each individual, the one that has become the whole gamut of, different individuals. So we can say that I can't be heard. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Fine. Yeah. All right. So that is another level at which this intuition of human unity is progressing. But there is an even greater, that's why I said that may be called anthropocentric. It has brought us to a certain point, but it is pushing us beyond the human. We are entering what one might call a post-human age, or even before we have properly entered a age of human unity, we are being pushed over the border and we are being made to confront the unity of the cosmos, the unity of the unique, the only one there is that has become everything here. And for that, we are drawing upon higher sources of the same intuition, the intuition that of the real idea, the intuition of that which has become this cosmos through its own idea or its own supramental reason.
So then that implies that practices need to, it seems like, to pay attention so that we can become more aware of that intuitive level and understand things, more things about it. I mean, just in terms of not so much, conceptually, sure, but also, how to actually live with it, if it's a relational intuitive, then we have to be able to recognize when that's happening and see where to take that intuition and understand when it, sometimes there may be false intuitions, there may be useless intuitions, because we're operating at best maybe at the level of the cosmos most of the time, not an absolute level. And also to maybe understand how to recognize the level of the absolute intuition.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think that phrase was very nice, how to live with it. Because this is, I believe, exactly what Sri Aurobindo is trying to do in chapters like this, where he's sorting out the ideas, which are also historical ideas. This is the reason why he's going to the pain of giving us the various ways in which mind has conceived of the relation or the intuition with the between the relativities and the absolute, and the flip that's needed to conceive of the nodus that he's talking about. And so the idea is over here, as we engage even our thinking with it, as we clarify our ideation with it, as we arrive at a kind of a concrete conception of it, that brings us into a closer relation with that, with the absolute, with that which has become the world of relations and the relativities. And then that, one has to live with that. That's, I think, the real key, idea. That's what Sri Aurobindo calls the basis of meditation. What is meditation? Meditation is to dwell in these ideas. to make these ideas the basis of our perceptions. Just as he puts in that persona and that long rational sort of argumentation that he puts out, so too that those are the personae that live in us and that we live as. And those persona have to be sorted out, and we have to live as other kinds of arguments inside us that give us a different perception as well as a different kind of, focus on our relations in the cosmos, with others, and with the absolute. So, as you said, also operating at which level? We have to operate at the level of knowing that the absolute has become the cosmos and become every entity in the cosmos. That is the relation. And if that relation is kept in focus to the extent that it is kept concretized in our conceptual understanding, then that is what becomes the living meditation. That becomes the living with it that we have to carry out till it starts becoming perception, till it starts becoming sensation, and it becomes experience, to lived experience. You may remember the famous, one of his thoughts and aphorisms with which, that is the aphorism that's used as an epigram in Sat Prem's Adventure of Consciousness, where he says, I become what I see in myself. Whatever thought suggests to me I can become. This should be man's unshakable faith, because God dwells in him. See? So this, I become what I see in myself. Now, this is not something that has to be read as a kind of positive thinking, that, whatever I want to think, I will become. That is a certain kind of reading of it, but the reading of it really is to think the highest thought, to think the greatest thought, to think the boldest thought. How far can the thinking go? What can we think of which is the closest to the absolute? What can we think of that makes the absolute the only reality amid all relativities? What can we think of that makes all relatives the absolute? That is the thinking that by thinking which I can become the only thing there is.
Is that same as Yo Yat Shraddha Sa Eva Sa?
That is the Gita statement, which is, you are what your faith is. And that is just one part of it, of course, that you are what your faith is. But what is your faith? What must your faith be? Your faith must be the highest reason. This is the point he's making here.
So it seems like you could study this sense of intuition and relation. Since the absolute includes all of it at any of the relative levels, and look at the relation of whatever portion of the cosmos that's connected to the absolute, since all of it is, to begin to get a feel for how you live with that and how you just stay with that that sense, and that it would be able to take you with your ability, with your with if you have faith, that it would be able to take you to learn more and to be and to dwell there easier, to dwell there more, to, you know, I don't know exactly how you I guess to maybe encompass more in your dwelling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we have to add to what you're saying, again, the, talking about aphorisms, the first aphorism or the first epigram of the synthesis of yoga, all life is yoga. All life is yoga has to be understood in this context as practicing what you're just talking about, practicing the intuition of that oneness, the intuition of the absolute having become all relativities, in every aspect of our life, not just in some aspect. And whatever aspect is given to us is a starting point. And whatever level of that intuition, as you said, is a starting point. But that starting point has to be exercised in every moment of our lives. And that is the real living. That is the kind of dwelling in, you know, that is the living in the idea. What Sri Aurobindo is talking about here is what may be called the integral thought. This is the integral thought, that in every entity, in every moment, in every movement, in the cosmos as a whole, in everything, the absolute is what exists as the cosmos and as every entity of the cosmos. Olga has been trying a number of times, so if she could please finish.
Thanks. I had a question about highest reason. I think I'm just trying to clarify something for myself because I'm not sure where that fits with knowledge, as in integral knowledge. And you just mentioned integral thought. So I'm wondering if when he says highest reason, he's talking about the development of a knowing which arrives at knowledge. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, absolutely. It would be a fair statement. So knowledge, again, that there are different dimensions of knowledge. So the highest dimension of knowledge is knowledge by identity, and that is wordless knowledge. That is the knowledge of the absolute, where the relativity ceases to exist. And you know that there is only one, and the one is undivided and unmanifest. See? So that is knowledge, that is the absolute knowledge. And that is also part of this. It's important to remember that. But that is not all of it. That then becomes the knowledge of the ideas by which it may know itself and by which it becomes whatever it knows of itself. See? So even that statement that I just made, you know, or I become what I see in myself, that statement is not just something we apply to our existence, but it is what the Brahman applies to its own existence. The Brahman has become this cosmos and has become every entity in this cosmos by seeing that in itself. And it sees that in itself following the idea of a certain self-exploration. So that is the gnosis. That is what has been called the gnosis. That is the supramental thought, the integral thought, the thought of the one in the many, all at once. So this is the other dimension, so that we can see the wordless one that is undivided, and we can see the self-division of the one following the idea of its own self-manifestation and self-experience. And knowing both these is the knowledge, the integral knowledge. So in the second kind of knowledge that we are talking about, that's the knowledge that proceeds as knowing in the different planes of our being, knowing through our senses, knowing through our emotions, knowing through our conceptions, knowing through our, you know, our psychic being. All these forms of knowledge are ultimately leading us to that integral knowledge, the self-conception by which the one becomes the world of the many.
So we're talking about parallel experience as well as knowing. There's the knowing in the experience.
Yeah, this is all knowing in the experience. Knowing by thought. Now, this thought is also part of that. That's also the knowledge of the mind. Conceptual knowledge is knowledge of the mind. That is a kind of experience. But that experience ultimately merges into real idea, which is the conception that sees itself manifest in other forms of experience as well. See? All these, so when you say parallel knowledge, yes, it is parallel knowledge. It is in every way of experiencing, including thinking as experiencing, it is arriving at that same knowledge.
Thank you. I think for the first time I'm getting an idea of what the real idea is. I've always approached it theoretically, but now it's beginning to clarify as something quite different, which is extraordinary. Thank you.
Yeah, quite. So we find again, since we were talking about intuition, the plane of cosmic mind closest to this real idea of supermind, idea that has become reality. That as reality becomes following its form, the closest level of cosmic mind is what Sri Aurobindo calls intuition with a capital I. So coming closer to real idea is to ultimately tap into this plane called intuition with a capital I, which we do not only with our conceptual intuitions. That's the plane that actually manifests as mental intuition, vital intuition, physical intuition, every form of intuition that we have. And that these forms of intuition give us the closeness to the real idea, bring us close to the experience of the real idea, the fact that that idea is what has become all these experiences, what is manifesting as the cosmos and as every entity and its experience in the cosmos.
So, Devashish, are you saying that that the intuition plane consists of manifestations of vital intuition, physical intuition, etc.? Or are you saying that, or maybe neither, I don't know, that intuition plane brings together the manifestations of vital, physical, and conceptual, all the different types of intuitions?
No, what I'm saying is that a real idea of supermind is becoming cosmos and all the levels of consciousness in the cosmos. And the intuition plane is that which has the grasp of this self-becoming. And hence, the intuition of the real idea is what is manifest at every plane of consciousness through the material, vital, mental, etc., intuitions. In other words, the intuition plane, the closer we come to it, informs our intuition at every plane. We become aware of the integral thought that I was talking about, or integral idea, since thought is something that is more properly kept to the realm of conception. The integral idea, is something we become more closely aware of at the conceptual level, at the emotional level, at different levels of consciousness, at different modalities of consciousness. We become aware of it in different forms of experience. Because the intuition plane is very close to the real idea of supermind, it actually manifests in all these levels of consciousness.
Okay, that sounds closer to what my experience has been.
Keka had a question or a comment.
I think I was, I don't exactly remember. I think you were talking about something, that integral thought that you were talking about. That one, I was just asking you if you could mention, excuse me, somebody's mic is on. I mean, unmuted or something? There's a lot of static is coming. I was asking you if you could mention that mother's statement about, that if you can think of the whole cosmos, at once or something, then you got a touch of divine consciousness or something. I don't exactly remember.
Yeah, that is the last message, New Year message of the mother. And I think Matteo read it out a few weeks back. Matteo, do you have the exact words?
I can in about 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay, I think because it will be best to repeat it in exact terms, as the mother said it. I can paraphrase it, but I think we'll wait for when Matteo gets the exact phrasing. We can hear it. But yes, I think that's wonderful. That's very appropriate. She's pointing to what one might call a cosmic integral thought, but over there we might think about it as a cosmic thought. In other words, becoming aware of the whole world there, she says, at the same time. When one can become aware of the whole world, or conscious of the whole world at the same time. So this consciousness, a kind of single consciousness. It's a consciousness that integrates our whatever we know of our being, our physical, vital, subtle physical, vital, mental being, and brings it into contact with this the relationship between the absolute and the cosmos.
I'm reading too many books at once. I can't remember what book it was in.
Let me see if I can find it.
Okay, here I have it. Okay, let's see one second. Yeah, 1973. When you are conscious of the whole world at the same time, then you can become conscious of the divine. When you are conscious of the whole world at the same time, then you can become conscious of the divine. It's almost a kind of a reverse formation of how the divine becomes the cosmos. Or becomes the world. Becoming conscious of the world, one becomes conscious of the divine. This is the integral thought. This is being close to the integral thought. This is part of the intuition of the integral thought. Because that is exactly, and I think what Olga was asking, what is that real idea? This is the real idea. The real idea is that the idea which has become the whole world at the same time, everything in it, as that single idea, essentially.
It implies an infinite awareness immediately. It's a beautiful statement, and it suggests this expansion of consciousness from the individual to become infinite immediately.
Yeah, absolutely. It implies both an expansion of consciousness and a implosion of consciousness. In other words, it's expanding to become the cosmos, and it's entering into some kind of an origin point from which all the entire emanation of the cosmos and all its entities is experienced all at once. It is operating simultaneously at two levels, expansive and in going within to a point which knows itself to be manifesting at once everywhere.
It feels to me like this is that what Gaebser describes as the aperspectival, that the intuitive encompasses the aperspectival.
So it's possible that Gaebser caught an intuition of something like this, and it's also possible that Teilhard de Chardin caught an intuition of something like this, which he called the new sphere, because he also speaks about the fact that he had an experience in which it was something of this kind, being conscious of the whole world at the same time. It was of this nature. It's a step, a very major step. It's that radical step. Now the aperspectival in Gaebser's case, again, he was talking about reaching a dimension in which other dimensions are contained all at once, and it's possible that there was something of this kind that he caught a glimpse of.
Well, and in the dimensions that he describes, he's describing all of human consciousness, basically. That, because he, the, you know, because before he talks about their combination, he talks about each one as a capability of human consciousness that reached its limits and people understood what its limitations were and then started reaching for something else. And
yes.
that the last one, before the a perspectival, he talks about rationality, and he calls it perspectival, the perspective. So it's the relative, right?
Exactly.
And then he goes into the a perspectival, and he talks about the right use of all of them.
Yeah, quite.
And it seems to me that the intuitive is what gives you the right use. That's where the spark is, the light.
Yes.
Debashish, on a similar line, the word concentration, I'm not sure whether it's Sri Aurobindo or the mother that uses that word, but I've always understood it as a deep meditation, but I'm wondering now how it applies to the vastness and the implosion that you're speaking of.
So this is a very profound question, Olga, because I think the mother has made a distinction between meditation and concentration, which actually I think at some point Keka put out on the True Person website. Maybe she can put it out again. But Sri Aurobindo also has a whole chapter on concentration in the Synthesis of Yoga, you will see. Now, at a certain level, the distinction does not hold, and this is exactly what he's trying to say over here, which is that this is also a concentration. It is the concentration on an idea, and at the same time, he's calling it a meditation. He's saying, a meditation is to hold an idea until it becomes a realization. And so here what we are finding is that this very complex idea, whether you look at it from that viewpoint of multiplicity, relativities in space and in time over different forms of evolution, as well as over different levels or ranges of consciousness, holding the fact that there is just one absolute reality that has become all this and holds all this together. That's the key to it, that holds it all together by one idea. And that is the gnosis. And that's actually what, the kind of the drift of this entire chapter is all about, the one that is becoming the cosmos as the container and the context for the self-manifestation of the many, each of which is none other than the same one who has become the cosmos. So this large idea, this vast idea, is something that is also a concentration. It's one may call it the largest concentration, and he calls it too a meditation in that sense, the sense of dwelling on this idea till it becomes a reality of experience.
Thank you. That's another great realization for today.
I think I didn't post it. I sent to a few people that we usually meet in LA. So I can post it soon.
Okay, that will be nice if you do post it. I think we've reached the kind of time sort of for this discussion past 9 o'clock, I want to mention that next meeting will be the second week, actually the fourth week of November. The next kind of scheduled possibility would have been the 14th of November, but I will be traveling at that time, so it will be the 28th of November. And I did receive some responses to the question of starting at 8 a.m. Again, going back, reverting back to the 8 o'clock morning, Saturday morning time. Not many, a few people responded. A few have difficulties. I think very few, one or two have difficulties. I hope that they will be able to solve their problems, because I don't think it'll be too complicated to you know, satisfy everybody. So I hope it will be okay. The others can listen in to the recordings whenever possible, and attend whenever possible. I hope that'll be fine. And if anybody else wants to respond or email me about this, we can discuss it.
So the next time it will be the Saturday of the fourth Saturday of November at 8 o'clock.
Yeah, 28th of November, 8 a.m.
Okay. Sure. So, Devasita, we'll stop now and continue then. I'll put up the recording soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Devasita.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye. Safe travels.